Thank you very much for coming, everyone. My name is Christina Biggs. I'm a local group leader for Christians in Science. Just briefly, if you haven't come across Christians in Science before, we're a national network, and just broadly kind of university scientists and kind of middle of the road, CUVE, Baptist, Catholic, Christians. Our literature's all here, so it's all free. Lovely goodie bag to take home with you. So we have a national, you can be a national member and you get emails and stuff. There's a sort of joining fee, it's £30 or so a year, which is very helpful for, but you also get to go to conferences and things. There's going to be a conference in October on miracles, and we get lovely sort of newsletters as well, just knowing what's going on in the country. So this group's been going since 2009, and there's recordings on the website of the previous talks. We've just been putting together the talks for 2017, so we're going to call it Science Informing Faith. We've got Ruth talking about beauty and science. We've got an archaeologist giving us the actual lowdown of what evidence there is and isn't there. I love finding out about holes in the evidence, more than, you know, knockdown proof. So that's exciting.
We just mentioned Keith Ward, actually.
Oh, yes, of course. Sorry. So the next talk is in September. And there's Ian Hollier talking about computers and life. And all the details are on that leaflet you got on the chairs. And there's more leaflets over there. And then the last big... yes, Sally?
You said September. It's actually
November. No, there is September. There's Ian Hollier. It should be on the same leaflet.
Oh, sorry, yes, sir.
Yeah, and then we've also got one in November, and that's Keith Ward, Professor Keith Ward from Oxford, who's a theologian, pretty well known, and excellent value for money. And he's going to talk about why Stephen Hawking is nearer to God than he thinks. And we're going to have it in St Mary Redcliffe, so that's in partnership with Journey into Science. And what's really exciting is that the British Science Association are wanting to put their logo on there. Leaflet as well, which is brilliant, isn't it? So donations, but the donations, we didn't charge entrance, we never do this, but if you feel moved, do put something in donations basket, just to cover, it's just like things like hire for the hall and things. So I think that's just on Christians and Science in particular. Lisa is my very good friend from our university days. We shared a graduate house out in the Sixth in Cambridge, and lots of conversations about C.S. Lewis and all the sort of thinking, and we like the brie, and Lisa's actually from the West Indies, so she's grown up there, and you just fantastic sense of humour, I think. Very, just thoroughly recommend. So Lisa's been looking into cognitive science and religion, and she'll explain more about that. But from what I understand, just a kind of heads up if you like, it's really the attempt by psychologists and etc. to explain away religion and saying, oh, it's just, you know, projection of your father and your mother and all that kind of thing, I imagine. So in case you feel threatened about that, then I'm sure Lisa will reassure us. So Lisa's actually a very long period with chronic fatigue syndrome, and that's sort of resurged a bit recently. And Lisa very wonderfully was saying how that actually did mean that she was sort of forced into spending lots of time with God. And that's why I was very excited that Lisa was sort of coming out of that with some insights for us. So I'll just pray for Lisa and then we'll start. Dear Lord, just thank you for what you've shown Lisa over these years of darkness, and just we're so excited to hear that you've raised Lisa up and what she's got to say to us. Bless this evening. Amen.
Amen.
So now that you know that I have an illness, if I pass out, it's not fear and terror. Well, it might be.
Just to say, this is an email list thing, so if you want to be on the email list and aren't already, we'll just pass it around quietly.
So, the cognitive science of religion, are we born to believe? The cognitive science of religion, or CSR as it's called, is a relatively new popular and a rapidly growing field in cognitive psychology. It includes a broad set of research areas, all of which converge on the aim of explaining the origins of religion, why people are religious, why we hold the beliefs that we do. Their intention is to provide a scientific explanation of religion without any reference to the necessary existence of supernatural beings or gods. Although scientific approaches to religion have a very long history, CSR didn't get started really until the 1990s. Yet despite that, it's a relatively well-established, and you may have come across its tagline, "Religion is natural," in the science journals and even in the media. What I'll be doing is I'll look at some of the approaches in CSR, specifically those which try to explain why we form religious beliefs about superhuman beings or supernatural agents, such as spirits and gods, ghosts or fairies. I'm going to present just a very brief overview of some of these theories and indicate the kinds of evidence, because what I want to focus on is the theological challenges that CSR poses to belief in God. And the first challenge is, of course, perhaps obvious. If religion refers to supernatural beings, then how are religious beliefs subject to scientific explanations when science only studies the physical natural world? The response to this is that this is possible because religious beliefs are in some sense natural. And by natural, it's meant that our minds function in such a way that religious beliefs come relatively easily to the majority of us. And so religious beliefs are natural, intuitive ideas that arise out of our ordinary experience of our natural and social worlds. And we'll see later how this is so. Because they're cognitively natural, we find them relatively easy to acquire, to remember, and to pass on. And so you have a quote here, that religion is natural, means that religious ideas and behaviors are widespread because there's something in human nature that immediately makes some ideas more plausible and easier to acquire than some others. The kind of broad evidence for the idea that religion is natural includes that it's pan-cultural, it's found in all human cultures, past and present. Other pan-cultural phenomena are music or sport. It's commonly found in the majority of people within each culture, and it tends to be acquired early in human development, and consequently, it's often more prevalent among children than adults. This idea that religion is natural is very different to what has been the prevailing view in our society, namely that religion is a purely cultural phenomenon. And so, you may be familiar, Richard Dawkins has argued that people need to be culturally indoctrinated or brainwashed into holding religious beliefs, and that this is particularly effective if the indoctrination begins during childhood. What CSS is saying is something very different. Actually, people don't need to be indoctrinated. We, and especially children, are natural theists. We're born believers. So Jesse Bering, one of the researchers in this area, concludes, "In fact, contrary to what many atheists tend to believe, recent findings from the cognitive sciences suggest that just like a crude language sprouting up, at least some form of religious belief and behavior would also appear spontaneously on a desert island untouched by cultural transmission, particularly beliefs involving purpose and origins. Beliefs about origins refers to the creation of the world." And Bering, by the way, is an atheist. This move from theories of indoctrination to naturalness is really a major shift in our thinking. It's a paradigm shift. And it is perhaps a little bewildering to those of us who are religious, and we're used to an increasing apathy and even hostility toward religious belief in our culture. It also raises its own questions and possible dilemmas for those of us committed to the theological truth, to the real existence of God. And I'm going to look now at three of the main theories about the origins of religious beliefs. trusted agency detective device. It's put forward by Justin Barrett. And the idea is, from an early age, human minds distinguish between physical objects, such as furniture and stones, and agents. And like objects, agents are self-propelled and goal-directed. They move without contact and have intentions. And although we most often think of humans as agents, actually our intuitive understanding is much broader. It includes, for instance, animals. And so Barrett gives the example of a lion walking into a village. You don't just assume that it's arbitrarily moving through, or you know, gravitation has sort of brought it down the hill. You imagine that maybe there's some ulterior motive. And in fact, experimental evidence suggests that an agent need only have one or two properties for us to identify it as an agent. So it might have a face, or just intentional action might be enough. So for example, in one experiment, when adults were shown two discs on a screen, one disc following the other, they tended to describe it as a chase. And many of them went further and talked about the intentions and mental states and emotions of the discs. And so the point is that an agent doesn't even need to look like a human or even an animal. In fact, the agent may not be visible at all. We're attuned to pick up signs of evidence of an agent from cues in our environment. Sounds, tracks, patterns, a neat pile of rocks, say, for example. We're sensitive to detecting agency in our environment because, of course, this has survival advantages. It enables us to identify the presence of other people, possible enemies, predators, prey. It's a crucial mental tool. In fact, according to Barrett, we are hypersensitive. So we're likely to mistake a large rock for a bear, but much less likely to mistake a bear for a rock. So we're really, it's very, very sensitive. So our natural bias is searching for agents and finding them. And because these agents don't need to look like us, they don't even need to be visibly present, it's argued we don't find it so hard to conceive that such beings as ghosts or gods exist. And so this is Justin's quote from him. We are on the lookout for agents that are non-human, unseen, and acting on the world when we're not looking. Secret agents. These abilities make it very easy to think about gods. Now we'll move on to another related theory, which is teleofunctionality. Because one of the consequences of us being primed and ready to detect signs of agency is that we instinctively search for it in the natural world around us. This search for agents, intentions, and purpose is called teleofunctional reasoning. Deborah Kieleman is the one who's done a lot of work studying this phenomenon, especially in children. And she's concluded that whereas adults tend to use teleofunctional reasoning to understand the functions, say, of animal parts, eyes are for vision, and for artificial objects, children tend to use it for all aspects of the natural world. They use it, for instance, for natural events. And she's shown children intuitively prefer teleofunctional explanations of such events as thunderstorms and floods. And so she did one study where she asked children, did the first ever thunderstorm occur to give water to the earth so everything could grow? Or did it happen, a purely physical explanation, because cold and warm air rubbed together in the clouds? The children preferred the teleological one. Interestingly, even when they primed the children with a story about physical explanations of natural events and said, isn't that great, cool, now think like that, they still went for the teleofunctional options. So there's, of course, nothing wrong with purely physical explanations, but it seems the children wanted and expected something more. They intuitively think that natural events happen for a purpose. This bias toward teleofunctionality was even more evident when it came to natural objects, mountains, rivers, and particularly so for animals. So for instance, in a study she did with children in a school in West London, Kielemann asked the children open-ended questions about why natural objects such as mountains exist, as well as creatures such as birds, and finally human artifacts such as hats. She asked about the human artifacts last, so as not to bias the children towards studio functionality. But consistent with the results of similar studies in other countries, the children still tended to give studio functional answers. And so, for example, they said mountains exist so that people can climb them or draw them, and birds exist to make the world look nice and to make nice music. In fact, she found that children were almost as likely to give a teleofunctional explanation, a made-for kind of answer for natural objects and creatures, as they were for human artifacts. When the children were then asked, subsequently asked, did someone or something make the first ever mountain or bird, or did it just happen? So they were given the options of someone, an intelligent creator, something, an unintelligent cause, or it just happened. 70% chose someone for natural events and objects. 80% chose someone for animals. And I think of those 70, when they asked them who that someone was, 76% identified it as God. Some of the younger children went for humans as the ones who had made the animals. But the older children, yeah. So Kielemann's conclusion is, the results not only indicate that children treat teleofunctional and intelligent design explanations of living and non-living natural entities as particularly viable, but that attributions of purpose are related to intuitions about intelligent design. In other words, children don't just identify purpose and function in the natural world. They seem to expect that it was put there by an agent, an intelligent creator. Now, how do we understand this? Well, Kielemann's own conclusion is that it's a case of promiscuous teleology. Children are prone to finding purpose and goal-directedness in everything, even where it's not warranted. Such an innate bias might exist because it has survival advantages. For example, it directs our minds towards searching for the functions of things. Everything becomes potentially useful. Natural objects become possible tools, for example. The other alternative, of course, is that it's due to the influence of culture. Most of Kielemann's studies were done in the US and the UK, and they have been replicated in other countries, such as Israel, Ecuador, Spain, and among the Maya people in Mexico. However, all of these countries have some kind of Judeo-Christian heritage. So there may still have been some exposure to the theological idea of design and purpose in nature. Work has been done in China at present, a predominantly secular country, the results of which should be very interesting. They've only released a summary, but the indications are that they still identify some form of agency. So we can talk about that in the questions. If it's not due to culture, then how do we understand the children's intuitions about purpose and agency in the natural world? Their view that natural events happen for a purpose. Whilst we could dismiss this, as Kielemann does, as promiscuous teleology, it may be that behind this is actually the more serious philosophical questions about ultimate causation and the nature of existence. Why does stuff happen? Why does stuff exist? Why does the universe exist? And with regard to their teleofunctional preference for explanations of natural objects and creatures, might this reflect that other well-known philosophical question? How can we ultimately explain the design and order in the natural world? In more adult language, how do we account for nature's beauty and intricacy and the emergence of features such as sentience and intelligence? Is it more reasonable to say that these things are purely accidental and unintentional, or to say that the evolutionary process was guided and directed by a divine mind? Now, evidence that telomere functionality made for ways of thinking are really hardwired into our brains has also come from the study of adults. So, for example, in some experiments done with university students, some of whom were doing science subjects, the students showed a preference for telomere functional explanations, especially when they had to answer quickly. When they were given unrestricted time, especially the science students, they went for physical options, but under speed, they tended to go for telomere functionality. So, for example, they preferred explanations such as the sun radiates heat because warmth nurtures life, and the earth has an ozone layer to protect it from UV light. A purely physical and non-theological statement would be, of course, to say the earth has an ozone layer, which, as it so happens, protects it from UV light, otherwise we would have been irradiated to death, but not to say that one thing exists for the sake of the other. They also included, by the way, some control questions, for example, whether eyelashes develop so that people could wear mascara, but the students always kind of recognize those control questions as well as explanations. Now, interestingly, in a study of physical scientists from top American universities, they found similar results. The professors chose physical explanations when they had no time constraints, but under time pressure, they showed an increased preference for teleofunctional ones. In fact, they were twice more likely to choose teleofunctional ones under speed pressure. However, it must be said that their overall preference for teleofunctional explanations was lower than was seen in the students and the other control group of adult non-scientists. So they'd obviously trained their minds to think non-teleologically. And finally, in Alzheimer's patients, apparently Alzheimer's patients also exhibit a strong tendency to revert back to teleofunctional language, suggesting again that these ways of thinking are stronger and deeper in the human mind. Now, the next theory, teleofunctionality in our lives. And Jesse Bering's the one who's done a lot of work on this. According to him, children and adults also have a strong tendency to see purpose in their own lives. Not the subjective sense that life is whatever you make it, but that deeper sense that there's some plan or destiny for my life, that my particular life was intended. Or in technical terms, that we have teleofunctional lives. One of the consequences of this, having a teleofunctional life, is that we have a tendency to interpret events as purposeful, even as signs and omens. And Bering has studied this phenomena in children in his Princess Alice experiments. In these experiments, children of various ages, I think from 3 to 9, were asked to choose between two boxes, one of which they were told had a hidden ball. And then they were told, some of them were told beforehand that there's a person called Princess Alice, and there was a picture of her up on the wall. She was a sort of cartoon clowns pretty creature. And she was a friendly magic princess, and she would help them. Then the children were then left in the room, and in some situations, when they touched one of the boxes, the lights would flicker, or in some cases, the picture fell off the wall. And when that happened, the older children showed a strong tendency to go to the other box, so to change their decision. And they were able to explain later that it was a sign from Alice that they were choosing the wrong box. The younger children were not affected in their decisions. They seemed to think that the picture falling and the lights flickering was due to Alice, but they didn't see any symbolic importance to it. So Bering concludes that children have a natural bias towards seeing the events of their lives as intended. Of course, they can be duped, as the experiment shows. But the point is that they were inclined to see some higher purpose at work in our lives. And it's not just children. Berent suggests that this intuition of teleofunctional lives is something that adults also commonly assume, and that this is particularly evident when something dramatic happens, when we go through a period of suffering or experience a narrow escape. We look for explanations of why these things happened in terms of other minds, preferring them to explanations in terms of chance or randomness. When we can't explain these events in terms of human or animal agents, then we tend to assign them to spiritual forces or gods. Yet interestingly, according to Bering, with Bering's work, it's not just religious people. Even atheists tend to speak, for example, of having gone through a bad experience so that they could do something, or it was meant to be, to reason it to your functionality in a teleofunctional way, as if there was some bigger hidden purpose at work. So we have a natural bias towards seeing the events of our lives as intended. Now, for those like Bering, this sense of purpose is just an illusion. It's a consequence of the fact that we interpret external events through minds, which as we've seen, are biased toward finding order, purpose, and agents. But I think, again, it poses a serious question about the ultimate meaning of life. Why do I exist? Why are we made in such a way that we're almost irresistibly drawn to the idea that our lives have meaning, some ultimate purpose? So with these kinds of experimental evidence and explanatory theories, CSR researchers seek to give an account of the origins of religion, to provide a natural explanation for religious beliefs. I'll just go briefly to some general criticisms. Although there's the evidence, experimental evidence is accruing for CSR, it is still a relatively young field. And so there will need to be wider, deeper empirical studies for its conclusions to be convincing. There needs to be more data. There are, of course, also technical difficulties, the supreme one being of how do you access what is in another person's mind. There are methodological issues too. CSR doesn't tend to take into account other explanations for religion, such as those given by sociologists and anthropologists, which tend to emphasize the importance of the emotions, bodily processes, and sociocultural factors. CSR also does not consider theological explanations of a particular religion, such issues as divine revelation, supernatural experiences, notable historical events, influential anointed individuals. So CSR doesn't really do justice to either the complexity of religion, nor to the way that religion is understood from within the faith. In response to this, though, CSR's researchers emphasize that they're not trying to marginalize other accounts of religion. They're not trying to replace other methodological approaches, nor are they trying to give a comprehensive explanation of the content of a particular religion. Instead, their concern is only to show that certain types of religious beliefs, such as belief in supernatural agents, arise naturally in the human mind. Although these are all important criticisms, I'd like to move on to consider the theological implications of CSR. Because if the conclusions of CSR are right, then it poses some possible challenges to Christian faith, which will be my particular focus. At first glance, of course, the conclusion that religion is natural might sound like an endorsement of religion. But that is not how CSR is most often interpreted, rather the reverse. In fact, one interpretation of CSR is that it disproves God's existence. It's argued that as science can explain, religion without making any reference to the existence of supernatural beings, then religious beliefs are unfounded and God does not exist. CSR disproves God's existence. So Akul Visala stated it this way. If we have a complete or sufficiently complete causal explanation of how belief in God came about, without any reference to the existence of God, then God does not exist. In response, however, it's not clear that CSR, as I said, provides a complete causal account, nor even is that their intention. Rather, their interest is just in identifying some of the possible cognitive mechanisms that contribute to belief. Even if it did provide a complete causal scientific explanation, that would not necessarily undermine theistic belief. These natural causal explanations might be consistent with theism, but I'll come to that later. Moreover, I'm not sure that CSR researchers themselves would unequivocally insist that no supernatural agents exist. Probably if they were asked directly, they would say science can't decide whether supernatural beings exist because science only studies the physical natural world, so such beings are at best highly unlikely. Nonetheless, this view that no supernatural beings exist is often implicit in their work. And behind this is a commitment to a strictly naturalist worldview. This is the metaphysical or philosophical claim that everything that exists is natural. Only natural physical entities and processes exist, no supernatural beings. And all events are fully explicable at a fundamental micro level. This contrasts, of course, with methodological naturalism of normal scientific practice, which doesn't consider supernatural beings or forces in its particular type of investigations, but doesn't exclude the possibility that they exist. Now, the fact that aspects of religion can be explained naturally, scientifically, by CSR, is taken as evidence that the strict naturalist worldview is correct and that indeed supernatural beings do not exist. So CSR is understood as an endorsement or a kind of proof for strict naturalism. And just in case you're confused, which you might be already, I don't know, strict naturalism is the philosophical belief that everything arises from natural properties and causes, and supernatural or spiritual explanations are excluded or discounted. Because discussions of CSR are often embedded in the strict naturalist worldview, and this is the grounds upon which religious claims about God are dismissed, I'm going to be comparing this to the Christian perspective throughout the rest of the lecture. I've already intimated at some of the differences between these two views with regard to the metaphysical questions about existence that I mentioned, the questions about ultimate explanations for the existence of the world and its characteristics. Why do things happen? Why does the world exist? Not how did the world come into being, not the Big Bang, but why? Why do I exist? Is there some ultimate purpose for my life? According to the strict naturalist position, there is no ultimate purpose. We saw that with Jesse Bering, for example. So while we have a subjective sense that life is whatever we make it, there is no ultimate purpose to our lives. As to why the world and stuff exists, in brief, we just have to accept that they do, they're brute facts, and if they didn't exist, we wouldn't be here to ask why questions. So in essence, the why questions about existence for strict naturalists tend to be not very interesting or even meaningful questions. And so Dawkins famously compares it to the nonsense question of why are unicorns yellow? Some questions simply don't deserve an answer. The fact that a question can be phrased in a grammatically correct English sentence doesn't make it meaningful or entitle it to our serious attention. They're not legitimate questions. Yet it's interesting that these questions have not only been pondered by the wise and learned throughout human history, they also occur naturally and easily to young minds. They're seemingly fundamental to our natures. Theologians, of course, are deeply interested in these questions and provide explanations for existence in terms of a personal creator, an uncaused cause. The world was created by God, and our existence was intended by God. Our lives do have ultimate meaning. And this is so deep and pervasive in Christian understanding that the next quote comes not from academic, not from academic theology, but from a blog. I'm not an accident. No matter how my birth came about, it was not a surprise to God. He had planned it long before I was born. And through him and in him, I can discover my life's ultimate meaning and purpose. Now, another approach is to say, not that God does not exist, but he probably does not exist. So CSR doesn't undermine religious beliefs, it undermines religious beliefs not by disproving or denying God's existence, but by showing that these beliefs are unreliable, and thus that faith is not rational. And the reasons for the unreliability are threefold. First, on the grounds that the religious beliefs are cognitive byproducts. The mechanisms in our mind that lead to religious beliefs originally evolved to solve other tasks. For instance, the survival aiding detection of enemy agents. So religious belief in supernatural agents is just an incidental byproduct of cognitive systems selected for non-religious purposes. The second reason is that these beliefs are often the result of quick and easy forms of cognition. The cognitive mechanisms involved are fast processing. They happen without us largely being conscious of them going on. So, for example, we identify and process the signs of an agent's presence and activity almost immediately and involuntarily. And this contrasts with the slow, deliberate cognition of analytical and reflective thinking. The latter form of cognition is, of course, deemed more reliable and rational, and the former as more irrational. And finally, third reason, cognitive mechanisms evolve tend to be exaggerated or overactive because this aids survival. So for example, there's more of a survival advantage in mistaking a rock for a bear rather than the other way around. And this hypersensitivity leads to false positives in which we see agents where there are none. On these grounds, the cognitive mechanisms involved are deemed unreliable and religious belief irrational. I'll say something briefly now about false positives, because I want to focus on the other two. Many have pointed out that the reliability of cognitive mechanisms such as agency detection is context sensitive. What that means is, if I hear a creaking floorboard and assume that there's an intruder in my house, that might well be a false positive. However, if I hear muffled voices or whistling or footsteps and make the same assumption, I'm likely to be correct. So the question is whether agency attribution in religious context is reliable or not. And this leads to a little bit of an impasse, with theologians saying, yes, they are reliable, and strict naturalists saying, no, they're not. However, perhaps a way through it is to note that we often evaluate the correctness of a belief by comparing it to conclusions we've made using other cognitive tools. So we don't tend to rely just on one thing. Including among the other cognitive tools and reasons for belief may be reasoned arguments, religious experiences, the influence of testimonies, and so on. So even if we decide that some cognitive mechanisms are unreliable, there may still be justified reasons for belief. But are the mechanisms identified by CSR really unreliable? Although we've tackled false positives, the emphasis for unreliability is primarily upon the other two. So, we'll turn to byproducts now. The view put forward is that because religious beliefs are byproducts of cognitive mechanisms selected for other purposes, as I said, they're necessarily doubtful in terms of their truth content. And so you'll see that in the following quote, enthusiasm is building among scientists for the view that religion emerged not to serve a purpose, but by accident. It's a byproduct of biological adaptations gone awry. If the term byproduct has a pejorative kind of connotation, then this is perhaps even more so for the not infrequently used other descriptor of parasitic. And so, for example, Pascal Boyer says, religious concepts are parasitic upon other mental capacities. Now, at one level, the concept of a byproduct is simply the biological means by which a trait is evaluated relative to the evolutionary outcome of survival and reproductive success, success at having lots of offspring. So belief in supernatural agents is a byproduct because it does not contribute to reproductive fitness. Instead, it's the outcome of a cognitive mechanism, such as agency enemy detection, which did contribute to fitness. Now, how you interpret this depends upon whether you decide this is a methodological constraint within evolutionary biology, which by nature of its interests must compare all things to evolutionary outcomes, or whether you go back beyond the biology and make the further claim that all traits that contribute, either originally in the present or the present, to reproductive fitness are worthy traits, and those that don't are worthless or unworthy. In the strict naturalist approach, of course, the matter of deciding upon categories of worth and unworthiness is not straightforward. These are value judgments about what is good and right, which go beyond the what is. An alternative view is, of course, to say that there's no need for us to ultimately evaluate traits only in the light of evolution. We might use other criteria, and in the theological perspective, if God is the creator, then belief in supernatural agents may be one of the ultimately intended outcomes of cognitive features, such as agents of detection. So it may be deemed worthy and for reasons not to do with reproduction. And Van Inbergen makes this point. Suppose that God exists and wants supernaturalistic belief to be a human universal and sees, he would see, if it were true, that certain features that it would be useful for human beings to have, useful from an evolutionary point of view, conducive to survival and reproduction, would naturally have the consequence that supernaturalistic belief would in due course become a human universal. Why shouldn't he allow those features to be the cause of the thing he wants? God might use evolved traits for his purpose. At another level, however, the criticism of religious belief as a byproduct is potentially more serious. The claim is that because cognitive mechanisms in religious belief are operating outside of their naturally selected function, they're inherently unreliable. The brain did not evolve. It was not fine-tuned and honed over time to make judgments about supernatural agents, only about natural ones. Similarly, the brain did not evolve to identify patterns in the natural world, the brain evolved to identify patterns of the world, so it could reason about events and so on in terms of animals and human agents, but not in terms of ultimate causation. So the use of these cognitive systems in religious belief to explain the ultimate causes of natural events and the overall design of animals in terms of actions of supernatural agents is beyond the brain's naturally selected function. In religious beliefs, therefore, the brain is being used outside of its realm of expertise. The question is whether the human mind is capable of thinking correctly about things other than its evolutionary interests, things beyond its original evolutionary locus. Is the human brain flexible enough to process other forms of knowledge? And in fact, there are other features that we consider culturally important that are seen as byproducts of the evolutionary process, including music, art, and science itself. Like religion, these are seemingly grounded in traits such as pattern recognition and cause and effect reasoning. And so, for example, with the case with music, music is a byproduct of the human capacity to identify complex sound patterns such as rhythms and pitches. and to discriminate between them, and this would be a benefit for human communication. It's a survival advantage, for example, of recognizing animal sounds. Yet it has become developed and stylized into what we call music. And so you have Dan Sperber's quote here. The ability and propensity to pay attention to and analyze certain complex sound patterns became a factor in reproductive success in human history. However, such sounds can be produced artificially, and they are in the next room, because we have an orchestra playing there. And they have been, in modern times, providing this module with a particularly rich cultural domain, music. The idea then is that humans have created a cultural domain, music, which is parasitic on a cognitive module. Other evolutionary byproducts, as I said, were art. Art involves various human capacities, one of which is the ability to recognize patterns of shape and color. In modern art, this is developed to become sometimes quite abstract and idealized. And so you have the quote here, artworks exploit evolved tendencies of the human brain, such as sensitivity to clear lines and marked color contrast, that is characteristic of the primate visual system because of the importance to the survival and reproduction of the organism. These cues are given priority, so they become well established. Other evolutionary byproducts, science, as I mentioned, involves recognizing patterns and regularities in the natural world and finding explanations in terms of cause and effect reasoning. These originally would have had evolutionary benefits, such as being able to predict animal behavior or avert threats. But in modern science, these cognitive abilities are used to generate complex scientific theories. The instrumental aspect of science, too, is said to be a byproduct of that more basic impulse for tool making. And so you have a quote here from Barbara Hanstein. Science arose in the course of efforts by our ancestors to solve practical problems of survival, so again, survival and reproduction. It appears to be an offshoot of technology, a byproduct of cognitive capacities and tendencies that evolve for more practically orientated activities. Thus, science is what Pascal Boyer calls in regards to religious concepts and practices parasitic. Of course, we can discuss the relationship between science and technology. I don't think anybody has decided what quite that relationship is. But anyway, that's how it is. So, Vassala concludes, all sorts of scientific and everyday things are also incidental byproducts of our cognitive systems. We're able to form beliefs about quantum mechanics, calculus, God, as well as about many other things, because our cognitive mechanisms that originally evolved to do something else are flexible enough to process all kinds of input. So although our religious beliefs and scientific theories are byproducts of our cognitive mechanisms that originally evolved for survival and reproduction, it does not mean that they're not true. It does not necessarily mean that they're not true. Is that right? Hopefully, we also wouldn't argue that science, art, and music are worthless because they're evolutionary byproducts. Rather, along with religion, they're often listed as one of the great accomplishments of human culture. The alternative to this is, of course, today that religious beliefs are not byproducts at all. They have adaptive evolutionary benefits. And, for example, it's pointed out that there are reproductive inducements associated with religious faith. For instance, religions such as Christianity place great value on children and procreation. They're advocates, too, for the view that such things as science and art are also adaptive. For example, producing good art and doing good science, for instance, may have reproductive benefits. I'll leave that, maybe we'll discuss that, too. My own view is that religion and science are probably complex phenomena. There may be some elements that are evolved byproducts, while others are more adaptive. Regardless of their origins, I have confidence that human cognition really is flexible enough to process these forms of knowledge with some accuracy and truthfulness. And I have that confidence for reasons of faith, which I'll come to in the next section, eventually. Right. Quick and easy cognition. The other reason for the unreliability is that it involves natural intuitions that are, religious beliefs involve natural intuitions that are cognitively easy. They're easily formed and transmitted because, as I mentioned, they involve fast processing systems that operate largely independent of conscious awareness or volitional direction. We don't need to think hard or even to be aware that we are thinking. The evidence for the ease of these intuitions is that they're plausible to large numbers of people, especially children, all of which indicates that they're natural, quick, and easy forms of cognition, unlike the slow deliberation or conscious analytical reasoning. And in the strict naturalist view, therefore, these intuitions should be treated as suspect. Although they may appear plausible, they are not true. They are illusory. And so, I refer to God as a cognitive illusion. This mental apparatus of ours evolved quite without need of the latter's consultation, let alone his being real. So now, the relationship between strict naturalism and intuitions and illusions is much broader than just religion. We've seen, these illusions include the idea of ultimate purpose and meaning. Other illusions are moral realism, that morals have real independent existence, human choice or free will, and for some, even the concept of the self. So the intuitions that we have about ourselves as agents, beings that are capable of intentional, real moral choices, may be natural and cognitively easy and nearly universal, but they're also wrong. And so strict naturalists not only deny supernatural agency, but some will also deny human agency also. Having said that, there are people who are strict naturalists, take a strict naturalist view of religion, but don't sustain that when it comes to human agency. And of course, intuitions about agency then are not only involved in religion, but our whole concept of human identity, personhood, civil society, justice, and so on. And just some quotes. The debate over free will is one example in which our intuitions conflict with scientific and philosophical arguments. Something similar holds for intuitions about consciousness, morality, and a host of other existential concerns. According to their view, that is, the scientists and the philosophers, free will is a figment of our imagination. And another one. The problem of the self, what it is that makes you you, has exercised philosophers and theologians for millennia. Today it's a hotly contested scientific question, and the science is confirming that there's no concrete identity at the core of our being, and that our sense of self is an illusion. These are just some kind of lightweight academic quotes. If you're interested, these are the kind of books by Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, Mark, and Bruce Hood, if you're interested in that. Now, others, not just theists, but some philosophers too, have argued that our intuitions about things like morality and human freedom are so universal that they should be accepted as facts. And if a worldview such as strict naturalism cannot give a good explanatory account of them, then we should question the worldview. And so you have here a quote from the atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel. There are doubts about whether the reality of such features of our world as consciousness, meaning, purpose, thought, and value can be accommodated in a reductionist as a strict naturalist universe. Vassala sums up this view among philosophers. Standard naturalism cannot explain objective moral facts or human freedom, and since we clearly have knowledge of such facts, naturalism is in trouble. So in essence then, you have two different, very different approaches. One is saying natural intuitions should be taken seriously, even taken as facts about the world. And the other saying they should be seen as suspect and intrinsically unreliable with regard to truth. Now, the problem with the latter view is that science itself is grounded on some natural intuitions about the world and human mind. Many of these intuitions arise so naturally and easily that they occur during development as children, and they're held by the vast majority of people. And so these include intuitions about the natural world, that the natural physical world exists. For most of us, this is a given reality. And if you ask children, they would just look at you with scorn, like, of course it exists. But not all adults would agree. Some worldviews and philosophies have developed complex reflective ways of thinking that enable them to deny that the physical natural world exists. Yet, of course, science is based on the study of this world. The second is that there's uniformity in the natural world. Rather than nature being capricious and predictable and mysterious, there are patterns and laws in nature that are consistent. If nature was unpredictable, then scientific experiments would, of course, be pointless. There are also intuitions about human minds, that humans can rightly perceive the external world, that human perception is reliable. Remember, we don't access the world directly or immediately. Everything is taken in by our senses. It's interpreted by our brains, which tells us what we're seeing and hearing. And we have to trust that our senses and our brains are doing a good job. And for the most part, we have the normal intuition that they are. And of course, one of the founding pillars of science is empirical evidence, sensory observation and experiment. And lastly, that human reason is reliable, that humans really can mentally grasp how the physical world works to discover and understand its cause and effect processes. This is what science aims to describe. And that human memory, too, is reliable. And so you have a summary. In science, it must be presupposed that our basic cognitive faculties, such as perception, reason, and memory, are by and large reliable. One cannot rely on observations without presupposing that sense perception is by and large reliable. One cannot conduct experiments without presupposing that reason is by and large reliable. These intuitions are assumed in science, and they're so natural and even obvious that most people wouldn't question them. However, as I mentioned, there's some people who disbelieve some or all of these intuitions. For example, some philosophers claim that no mind-independent world exists, and some postmodernists would argue that humans can never really access and know the truth about external reality, the world out there. The Christian faith, I would argue, strongly supports the belief in these intuitions. It's evident, for example, if you've read Genesis 1, that there's such a thing as creation, that the physical world exists. Further, it's an orderly creation. God has put order and regularity into the natural world, so we can expect uniformity. This is grounded ultimately in the character of God, who is himself reliable and faithful. Finally, the biblical view is that humans are made in God's image and likeness, so we may expect that our minds will rightly perceive and reason about the workings of nature. Because we bear an affinity, a likeness to the divine mind, we can have confidence in human minds. This is why I said, regardless of the natural origins of human cognitive skills, whether they're byproducts of evolution or otherwise, I have confidence that our minds can think truthfully about the world and about God. Now, this is not to say that the findings of science and science is intuitive. They're not. The findings of science are not. Although science is built on some intuitive natural assumptions, scientific discoveries themselves, the facts and theories, are sometimes highly counterintuitive. We might have some physicists here who can tell us all about what the universe is made up of, which is some strange dark energy and all sorts of wonderful things. There are, of course, non-intuitive elements in theology too. There are counterintuitive doctrines such as the Trinity, the idea of the transcendence of God. Christianity also has a long tradition of reasoned and analytical thinking. So although there may be elements of religious belief that are natural and intuitive, there are also reflective and analytical aspects too, as there are in science. In summary, I would suggest that intuitiveness, fast and easy cognition, is not a good reason to discredit belief. Neither, for that matter, is counterintuitiveness. And the reality is probably that all forms of human knowledge contain both intuitive and counterintuitive elements. I'm going to change tack a little bit. Michael Ruse, philosopher, has brought another argument against religious belief on the basis of CSR. And what he's argued is that CSR's account of religious beliefs is morally incompatible with the Christian faith. For instance, if our hypersensitivity to agency is because of our fear of predators and enemies, then does this make evil the means by which God creates faith in the believer? And so Ruse says, one therefore seems to be in the position of saying that religious beliefs come about through and only through really vile acts. I think this is a fair criticism, and it's not the time or place now to discuss the origins of predation and death, so-called natural evils, but I'd like to make some response to Ruse's criticism. While there's no doubt that our sensitivity to agency is intensified by the possibility of threats in our environment, does it mean that these evils are necessary? In other words, is it the only way that our sense of agency could develop? Can we not imagine a scenario of growing up in a non-hostile environment where we may still be interested from motivations of, say, curiosity and affection, in recognizing signs indicating the presence of other humans or animals? We might still be interested in agents. Alternatively, it may be that in such a world, belief in God comes primarily through means other than intuitions about agency, for example, by direct revelation. The CSR need not imply that evil is necessary for faith. Even so, given that if CSR is right, is it acceptable for God in the real world to use such evil means, to use means as evil agents? Is it acceptable for God to use such means as evil agents? Given the reality of evil, can God use it for good purposes? Of course, the biblical answer to this is yes. And the supreme example of this is the death of Jesus Christ, which came about through the petty and religious political ambitions of those around him, but also happened because it was divinely ordained. And so in Acts it says, Jesus was crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men, according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, in order that we might receive forgiveness for our wrongdoings through his death and resurrection. The crucified God can work all things for good, even suffering. Right, the final objection. We're nearly there. Someone said yay? Sorry. Okay, our final objection today is that God's existence appears to be unnecessary. If CSR offers an explanation of religious beliefs without any reference to the real existence of a supernatural being, then whether God exists or not appears to be irrelevant. In other words, people would still be religious even if there was no God. We could phrase this in terms of the principle of parsimony, which said Occam's razor, which says we should not invoke more causes than are necessary. Human biology and psychology and CSR provide sufficient explanations, and so the additional explanation of God's existence is superfluous. And so you have a quote here from Mithun. Religious thought is a consequence of cognitive fluidity. In this regard, there seems to be no need to invoke a moment of divine intervention that initiated the start of revelation. For me, therefore, there is no supernatural, no God to be revealed. So CSR is enough. In response, as I mentioned before, it's not clear that CSR provides a complete causal account of religion. It's it's not even their intention, although it's interpreted that way. Also, as I mentioned, there may be other factors that lead to an individual's belief, including reasoned arguments, supernatural experiences, and so on. Moreover, it's always possible that even if we have natural causal explanations for belief, they could be compatible with God's existence. Indeed, if God is the sovereign creator, then we might even expect that he would use natural causes such as our natural cognitive systems. This is because in Christian theism, God interacts with the world both miraculously by bypassing natural processes and also providentially by working in and through natural processes. God can work through secondary natural causes. And this is nicely explained in the following quote. So God, in his providence, he sustains all things, he preserves creation, he works through the properties of all things, causing them to act in accordance with his will, and he directs creation. So even if we had a fully natural explanation for belief, it would not necessarily be a problem, I would suggest, for Christian theism. And the atheist Daniel Dennett makes this very point. It could be true that God exists, that God is indeed the intelligent, conscious, loving creator of us all, and yet still, religion itself as a complex set of phenomena is a perfectly natural phenomenon. So it could be fully natural but and consistent with the existence of God. And I would suggest that God's existence is actually a good explanation of CSM. Because there is a creator of God, our minds have been made in such a way that in our normal, natural, and social environments, we're inclined toward belief in God. God's existence is a good explanation for the naturalistic belief. This would not be something that theists have recently invented to accommodate CSR, but actually us returning to a much older theological idea, one indicated by Aquinas, to know in a general and confused way that God exists is implanted in us by nature, but which I think is best described by John Calvin. That there exists in the human mind and indeed by natural instinct some sense of deity we hold to be beyond dispute, since God himself, to prevent any man from pretending ignorance, has endued all men with some idea of his Godhead. This is not a doctrine which is first learned at school, it's not cultural, but one as to which every man is from the womb his own master, one which nature herself allows no individual to forget. This idea, of course, has biblical precedent in passages such as Romans 1, 19 to 20. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things which have been made. So natural human cognitive systems incline us towards some form of religious belief because human nature was created by God. I think this is at least a consistent and a reasonable and even a good explanation. And finally, last quote, expresses it this way. God created people with the capacity to know and love him, but with the free will to reject him. Consequently, our God-endowed nature leads us to believe. But human endeavors, apart from God's design, may result in disbelief. If CSR is right, then we are naturally inclined to believe in God. But we also have a choice. Thank you.
Yeah, we haven't had a question time after that. I just wanted to say that I just spellbound, I think we're all spellbound, because the train of thought for this particular subject is, you know, you have to sort of take on board, you know, the full negative, you know, impact of what they're saying, their reasoning and everything, and, you know, and then to sort of go through that and then have the kind of tenacity of mind to kind of fight through the jungle and come out the other side. It's amazing. I just can't believe it. So this, can we just thank Lisa?
Enduring an overlong lecture. I really apologize. I realized it was too long. day before I came down, and I thought, oh my goodness, what do I cut out?
Lisa, I think that was amazing. Yeah. I haven't sat under such a deluge of 7 and 8 syllable words since I was at theological college and before that at university. So I thought it was mind-blowing and wonderful. But the question I have is that I'm wondering why we have given in to the philosophy that has claimed nature in place of God. I went to university, I came down from university the year that Richard Dawkins went up to read biology and Stephen Hawking went up to read theoretical physics. I came down for reading mathematics. And I've smelled a mathematical rat in every part of the ruling paradigm. We've given in, we've let them take over nature as separate from God. And I want God right back in there, because where a Big Bang is a philosophy, and a singularity under infinite gravity is not going anywhere, let alone bang. And yet we've said that it can all come out of it. And we've given them the word evolution as if it is undirected and coming out of some small life, and how did that come, and how did atoms come? The whole thing is a charade of nonsense, typical demonic nonsense, and we've given it too much credibility. So these guys are claiming God's direction for nature, but keep God out of it. And I want to get God right back in there.
I want to challenge you, Tony, if I may, because I think there's a dualism in what you're saying. I think what Lisa's saying is that CSR may well be the mechanism which God uses. There's nothing wrong with the theories of CSR, but God is using them. And that's the same with the Big Bang and evolution. It's not... There's no jiggery-pokery, it's just they're missing out what we all believe in, the divine that is directing it. But I think you want to be very careful about some of the other language, about, you know, some of the mathematical things. I think that's irrelevant. God can work through things we see as mathematically improbable. But it doesn't mean that they didn't occur that way.
That's right. That's right. It's interesting, Richard Dawkins has a book about the magic of reality, where he tries to take teleofunctionality and deconstruct it and give it an atheist explanation. And he says, and I think this is not right, he says supernatural explanations and natural scientific explanations are in competition. And so if you have a supernatural explanation, then you're pushing out science. And that's not right. That's not Christian theism. So, I think that's mistaken.
At the back, Green.
Yeah, I wanted to revisit what you said about, probably leading on what you just said, really, is that the natural brain can't see the supernatural. And is not one of the issues here, in the same way that science can't measure the weight, the speed of love, or the weight of the glance, that we are missing out?
The thing is, science has been hugely, hugely successful. And I love science. I mean, I'm a theologian now, but I read a science journal and it's like I'm a different person. I just feel happy and enthusiastic about the world. It's like a personality change. And science is just absolutely brilliant. But what has happened is, because it's so successful and so wonderful, people have said it's the only way that we can know the world. It's the only epistemology, it's the only way that we can access truth about the world. And because you can't access truth about supernatural beings through science, then they can't exist. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so in this situation, we've got a scientific and peer-reviewed look at cause and effect. And because it's so predominant, and that cause and effect therefore is being accepted as something behind it, but it's then denying the thing that most people believe is the cause.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make good sense, does it? That's almost unscientific in a way. Yeah. It's definitely not a good philosophy.
Yeah. No, say, like Kielemann, I mean, she's coming to it, it's not warranted. There is no God. The way the children are thinking is not warranted. And she has papers now about how do you adjust their thinking. Yes.
A number of issues. You raised, you tended to use the word belief rather than faith, and belief is really more about intellectual assent. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that the Christian faith is primarily about that. Faith is trust rather than intellectual assent. Secondly, for myself, I'd reject the category of supernaturalism. It's not, as far as I'm concerned, and never was, a Christian category. It's a creation of itself. And because the Christian faith isn't primarily about intellectual assent, and because there's no such thing as proof in science, if there isn't proof, there cannot be disproof, and that applies both to science, theology, any other discipline you care to mention. There's a difference between proof and well-attested theories, but the fact of the matter is that 95% of scientific theories end up in the waste paper basket. That's the historical reality.
Yeah, and it's not, most people wouldn't argue we have a realist knowledge of science and theology. So we don't have absolute, pure, certain knowledge. We have a critical realist. We have, you know, And the reason I use belief is because that's CSR's language.
But
I can see what you're saying.
But I think it's important to emphasise those sorts of aspects of it. It's not primarily intellectual, but if you like, for, you don't see and then have faith. You have faith, then you see. So, in a sense, it's which goggles you're putting on.
Yeah, depends how you come to it. Because I know people who have come to faith absolutely through recent argument. They've been convinced, okay, they have no personal interest in God, but they're convinced that he exists, and that's where they begin.
Yes,
that's where I was thinking.
Hello, thank you so much. A not entirely unrelated point, actually, but there is a, born to believe, but there is a rich theological tradition, Augustinian.
Yes, he was in my notes.
We're born lovers rather. I wonder whether you see in, say, the priming of the brain relation to relational seeking as a developing strand within CSR of inquiry.
Matt Rosano has written a book, Supernatural Selection, and he says that the way to understand things like CSR and religion, the way to really bring them together is through relationality. And to see relationship with God as an extension of our social worlds into the transcendent. So I think you would find that really interesting, his book.
Thank you, very interesting talk indeed. Denver at the front mentioned the Big Bang. If my memory serves correctly, that was probably Mark Bell and Bruce. The other point I'd like to make is that towards the end of your talk, you spoke of your personal belief in God as opposed to the scientific aspect. And the question that always occurs to me is, had you been born in a different culture, let's say a Confucianist culture, not China, the overwhelming statistical probability is that you would not now be a Christian, and more significantly, you would not believe in God.
Yeah.
And it would be interesting, actually, you said that there's some tests been undertaken on children in China. It would be interesting to get those results.
Yeah, in China, the reason I didn't mention it in the talk is because I've only seen that they haven't been published yet. So I didn't want... I haven't seen the published results, so... But apparently, the children have a preference for something which is called, to explain what happens in nature and natural animals and natural events in terms of chai, which means breath or air, and it's a kind of a living force, a kind of vitalism, which is behind traditional Chinese medicine and the martial arts. And so they have a preference to a kind of agency. It's not a god, it's not a personal agency, but it is a kind of vitalistic force within nature.
I just comment there. I was sitting there thinking about other religions, but I thought, in a way, you can take the existence of religions around. Just this is the same argument you're using for science, music, art.
Yeah.
The fact that we, you know, have kind of erroneous religious beliefs is kind of saying that, you know, God is letting us sort of evolve and have our own ideas, and if you like, that the mechanisms that give us this natural belief, maybe that CSR is kind of right in that it's not completely reliable. I mean, I remember you talking about science, you're saying by and large we have scientific intuitions, they're by and large correct, and we have scientific, you know, errors as well as, so, but I'm not saying that means religion is completely wrong, it just means that you can't accept, and if everything is religious, just like everything that's science is completely, and it's just how God likes us to develop and develop our own ideas, and it's like further evidence that God's using a natural process, but it's not the only process that he would use,
no.
You know, to get faith, and he does directly reveal himself to people.
Yeah, he does.
So it's just like one of many mechanisms that God would use, just as, you know, science is, you know, one of many ways of discovering God's wonder.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a scientist to see the whole of God's glory, and you don't have to be a musician to have a higher sense of love. You know, they're all different and complementary things, and you can't name any one of them as the only route.
Would I say that? No.
I was saying that.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't saying you were saying that. No, I think I was trying to say was that I'm kind of, I like this CSR, if you like, because not all religious belief is going to lead to God, because there are different ones, and that's what to be proof.
CSR would say, that it kind of gives you an intuition of supernatural agents, but it's culture that, as you were saying, culture that... Having said that, that's not quite true, because Justin Barrett has argued that actually our intuition about supernatural agents are that they are all-knowing, and he kind of links that to goodness. I'll come to that in a minute, but the idea of all-knowing, for example, with Chinese children, they have an experiment where they have two boxes, and they, you know, they had one box, and they said, which of two toys is in the box? And they said, well, would humans know? Would animals know? And then they chose a supernatural agent. So it could have been one of the gods from Chinese mythology, one of the sort of magic superheroes from literature. And the children were quite clear, no, humans wouldn't know, animals wouldn't know, but the supernatural agent would know. So actually we have some kind of content to believe. And Barrett then goes on to argue that because moral judgments about, we decide our moral, make our moral decisions based on knowledge, and so if we fall, we do something wrong, we say, oh, it's because of, blah, blah. And so supernatural agents who have all knowledge at their disposal will be good. They will make right moral judgments. So they actually argue there is some kind of content to believe.
So you're saying then that we challenge, like, when we have when somebody dies and they say it was meant, or they'll have a kind of completely random encounter and they say, oh, that was very serendipitous. You know, can we actually challenge people on that then? You're saying that we can actually use that sense of coincidence and actually get them to try and explore that?
Yeah. But you want to do it in a sensitive way. If it's death, you don't want to say, yes, but that's an illusion. But really, you want to be,
I'm quite interested by the idea of born but to believe in. Anecdotal experiences of talking to children.
Yeah.
Or more to the point, when children come out with something that you quite unexpected, which indicate agency, as you put it, as God's hand in something. And I can think on so I have two children, and I can particularly think of occasions when they've come out with something, the timing of it was so significant, and you just thought, well, actually, they're speaking truth that the years wouldn't necessarily portray.
No.
Most recently, my son, I said something to my wife about something that was in my heart. I think I felt, wanted to share with her. There's, virtually in the same day, my son, unknowingly to what I had said, wrote down something and pinned it up on the fridge. And it was almost word for word, that's what I shared with my wife.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that, I just wondered whether CSR, kind of that approach, that way of looking at things, looks at that kind of propensity from type of children to say things that are far wiser than...
No, yeah. Well, two things. I mean, most CSR researchers are atheists, so there is no God. So it is not real. Whatever we see is not real. But interestingly, about children, they monitored parent-child conversations, and what they found is that although children prefer teleological explanations, parents, including Christian religious parents or other religions, tend to give non-teleological answers. So when they say, why did this happen? They give a kind of physical explanation. You know, it happened because the rain fell or whatever. So you're right. Children they seem to be primed for agency, but it's interesting that even within a religious context, we kind of train them out of it a little bit. It seems that way. Does that answer your question?
Can I? I didn't quite make the point of the question about previous, which is
yes.
So my question really was, if that is the case, then how fundamentally true can a belief be which is highly dependent on geographical location first, if not culture?
Well, the idea that if I was born in China, it assumes, I guess, that we have a immortal soul. Is it? Because obviously if I was born in China, I would not be me.
that doesn't explain what the China would say. If you were born in England, you wouldn't be here either.
Right.
Yeah.
And the idea as well that God is involved in his world. The quote said, my birth was not an accident. It wasn't a surprise to God.
It's interesting with you, was it Chai or Kai, meaning birth?
Yes,
equivalent to spirit or ghost, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But isn't this where the Christian faith is unique in the incarnation, because God reveals himself in a unique way, and that is also a way that we can use our reason.
Yeah.
Looking at the evidence, the resurrection is teaching. So there is something, I think, unique, so that even a person from another culture, if they were, we believe as Christians, were presented with that, would find themselves seeing the real God.
Yeah. And what the sensus Calvin and the sensus divinitatis says is, you know, what it says in Romans, just from the created world, there is some knowledge. God has given some knowledge to everyone. And of course, people are held accountable for the knowledge they have, not the knowledge they don't have.
I think, I mean, that does sort of link into the kind of, well, you know, these people in Africa, and it's not their fault, they weren't, you know. I think I sort of take comfort from the fact that, you know, Christianity is pretty much all over the world right now. And I guess there's also the other aspect that people have never heard. God does have a way of dealing with them. I mean, like people called Christ, for example, and I mean, like people like Melchizedek in the Dark Bible. He's not a Christian, but he's a priest of God, and he, you know. So I think you can trust that God won't kind of. I guess we're just worried about hell, aren't we? That's the question, isn't it? That these poor guys have grown up and they haven't had a chance to hear the good news,
and
they're going to get dispatched to hell. And I think we can trust that God is a just God, and He would take account And we don't know what kind of input they've had in their lives. I mean, there's, you know, as Lisa was saying, there's the natural world around us, which, you know, and then these children are naturally making it think, you know, so we do have that intuition. And maybe what culture is trying to kind of, no, it's not a personal God, it's just, so, but maybe that there's enough of that to lead people to believe where they have, you know, and I guess there is, you know, why doesn't God just write himself across the sky and, you know, and introduce himself personally to everyone? So there is, you know, this journey we have on Earth, and we're all interactive, and there's this excitingness of that sort of discovery gradually through our lives. So why would, you know, why do we start off at zero and God just says, hi, this is me, you know, let's just start now. You know, it's more interesting this way, isn't it? I mean, I don't think God would waste human souls in that way, if that's what people are worried about.
Well, theologians would say that because there needs to be a little bit of distance.
Yeah,
for us
you have to
make
see
a choice.
Yeah.
Was a question.
So I wanted to ask you about if CSR has done anything towards determining that he got a preference for monotheism, polytheism, and pantheism.
Right.
Or is that entirely cultural?
Yeah. And so Barrett would say there seems to be, you know, certainly a kind of an all-knowing and good God seems to be somewhere there in the content of what we believe. But others would say, well, you know, we have polytheism and we have monotheism. You know, obviously culture makes a big difference as well. So am I answering your question? Not really.
I think what you're saying, Lisa, maybe, is that CSR in the absence of culture, you know, the naturalness of CSR that we've been talking about all this time, it is the way that God's made the world so that our minds are sort of...
Will it take you to monotheism? And some would say yes. And some CSR would say it could do. It could bias you towards that. And there's an article... by Mawson, arguing that thing, that it does take you to monotheism. I'm not convinced. I think culture is actually quite important.
And revelation as well.
I was more thinking just in Revelation 1, it's sort of outward, towards
It gives us an idea that there's a creator, and there's some content to what that creator, who that creator is.
Cool.
Another sort of pan-cultural idea, I guess, is moral sense of right and wrong. And do these scientists study this? Do they relate it to purpose? Or is it something that's sort of connected only in religion?
Morality, yes. That was going to take me into another thing I had. That bit I did cut out. There's a whole other area of science which is related to CSR, which is the evolutionary science of religion, and there they argue strong, there they go into morality and the relationship between evolution, morality, belief in God.
Is that Sarah Crickley?
She might have done something. She did do, yeah.
She was looking at the kind of evolution of altruism. Society.
That's right, with Martin Novak.
Similarly to CSR, she's arguing that God is shaping, you know, the way that our natural world is inclining us towards altruism rather than selfishness, and that all the sort of explanations of why people are naturally altruistic, they're kind of having to go into game theory and, you know, very devious, selfish reasons when actually just being altruistic, and that's perfectly natural because God made us that way. One more.
What's the straight naturalness argument for the reason why people have a spiritual side? I mean, like, you know, even atheists seem to have, you know, some part in terms of Dawkins' arguments against him almost, because he was making a religion in his arguments.
Yeah.
But what's that argument from an evolutionary point of view, why we have this, why humans have this sort of need and spiritual?
So CSR would say, you know, it's because for survival we're really primed for agency. And so we're just kind of agent obsessed. And so we just get kind of overworked and it flows out into the transcendent. So, yeah. But I don't think that's a fair criticism of children's and their reasoning about the world.
It's a bit like with pets, isn't it? You know, people who spend a long time with their cats and dogs, you know, and they'll be insisting, you know, all sorts of, you know, and then I suppose some people think, oh, they're just cat lovers. And, but, you know, if you spend a really long time with, you know, these entities, you know, God might have given cats and dogs that, you know, that kind of sense. And you know, when you've had this long experience, I suppose there's a lot of explaining away of you know, you've had all this experience and you're trying to make sense of them, and this is your, you know, your strategy for making sense of your world and stopping it collapsing around you. I guess that's a CSR argument as well, the survival thing, isn't it?
It comes down to trying to root it in survival and reproduction, really, is because that brings it into biology and into science. And say it's illusions. Yeah.
Any other comments?
Go on. Well, it's just a quickie. There's Karl Barth, the theologian, Arno the Catholic theologian, and one talks about the anonymous Christian, and then one about secular parables. And it just strikes me that the chap's saying about, you know, Chinese, etc. But actually, there's a potential here for this to actually get back into theology in the way I think you've started to.
With that, thank you, Gabby. Really, so I just felt with, you know, just like with Glyn gave us this talk, Glyn Harrison gave us this talk back in March about self-esteem, and we were kind of looking at it and thinking, oh, but I like self-esteem, and Glyn was kind of turning it around, and I think you're managing to do this as well, and just, you know, I really hope you publish in this area a little bit further. I think there's a lot of strong things to be said here and challenging and turning it around. I mean, obviously not turning it completely around in a simplistic way, but actually thinking, well, hang on, you know. And I think you've got this amazing...
Yeah, I think there's a lot that's really interesting and useful in CSR. And, you know, if you're religious or a Christian, you know, don't be put off by the way that it's sometimes handled and interpreted.
I mean, just as we shouldn't be threatened by biology or chemistry or physics or anything. Yeah. It's just ways of understanding this incredible world.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Lisa.